Saudi women need to be the ones that are defining what it is that they need in the workplace. And it shouldn't be a narrative that's imported from outside of the kingdom and just kind of cookie cutter. We need to do this with D&I and we need to do that's not going to work. I think Saudi women have needs that are their own and they need to drive that. And a lot of it will overlap with global needs and global women's challenges. There are a lot of shared and communal challenges, but there are also ones that women in Saudi Arabia need to outline and define themselves.
This is the 966.
This is the 966, episode 126. Assalamu alaikum. Hala wala. Ramadan Kareem to everybody. Hope that you're doing very well this season, having a blessed and blissful Ramadan, getting some good time in with your families. It's great to be here in Riyadh for Ramadan with my family. As some of you know, I'm fasting alongside my fellow brothers and sisters here in Saudi Arabia and around the world. First time doing it, pretty wild. I'm going to come back to this shortly. In just a few moments, we will get to my conversation with Dr. Hannah Al-Moyabid, who is a London-based researcher, academic, analyst, and consultant who focuses on Saudi Arabia's labor market dynamics, employment, youth, women, and more. I met Hannah at the Human Capability Initiative in Riyadh a few weeks ago. We were both speaking at the event and supposed to do an onstage interview together, but ended up not being able to do it. So we just agreed to take a rain check and do it on air together. Actually thrilled with that outcome. Not gonna lie. Hannah is just really one of the more capable communicators I've ever met. Her knowledge, not just about Saudi Arabia's labor market and employment in the kingdom, but really all things Saudi Arabia, is impressive. As you'll hear from her discussion, with me, her personal story, her mother is American and her father is Saudi, and she grew up in both places. We're going to nerd out a bit on the Saudi labor market and how that is changing under Vision 2030, talk about the emergence of the private sector for the Saudi economy, really so much more. So stay tuned for that in just a few minutes. Thanks to everyone for their support for the 966 for 126 episodes now. It's been awesome to have people tune into this and speak with them about it here in person. Before I share with you my interview with Hannah, my one big thing this week, as I teased before just a minute ago, Ramadan. This is my first Ramadan in Saudi Arabia. As many know, I'm here with my family, not sure what I expected before Ramadan, but I had heard different things, conflicting things ahead of time, mostly people's fond memories of Ramadan and what makes it distinctive. As I'm sure many of you know, I am not a Muslim, but I'm living here now with my family. And I was very curious to measure the preconceptions and the information that I got about Ramadan against my own experience here. So I was actually quite excited about it. And since Saudi Arabia really is changing so quickly, it was just kind of cool to see what everybody was saying about Ramadan. Oh, you're going to love it. It's a great time. It's really a wonderful time for friends and family. It's very different, you know, to get those pieces of information beforehand and then now to be experiencing it about 1 week in here in Riyadh. As I mentioned earlier, I am fasting for Ramadan like my friends here, going all in with it. It's now been about a week. Really wanted to know what it's like and how hard it is to do. As I mentioned, I'm not a Muslim. I'm really just doing it because I wanted to both experiment, see with my friends what it's like, but also, you know, all my friends, all my boys are here doing it. Let's do it together. Let's see if I can do it. If I can't, more respect for my friends. If I can, now I know what they're going through every year. I have not, first of all, broken the fast once yet, and I'm quite proud of that. I would have said that I probably would not have made it about a week into it without breaking the fast. And I just sort of want to talk about that for a second. My first day of doing the fast, you know, no eating all day until the call to prayer came, which is usually is about right after 6 o'clock. The Maghrib prayer, which you can hear very well from my apartment here in Riyadh, that's when it's okay to eat and when I was allowed to break the fast. The first day that I did it, of course, all wrong. I need to just say right now, I want to thank my dear friend Abdulaziz, who lives 1 minute away from me here in Khatin. He has brought me dinner over every single night and really right before the Maghrib prayer. And I'm certain that his mother is doing the cooking over there. He hinted as much. My goodness, she is wonderful. He's probably dinner every single night. And going back to my day one of fasting here, right as the call to prayer comes along, I'm so hungry that I just dig right in. First couple days I do that and I say, you know, I feel like maybe I should be losing some weight because I'm not eating all day. and realize that I wasn't losing any weight. And I think the reason was is because right at the call to prayer time, right when I was allowed to eat, I mean, I just went crazy. And who can blame me with Abel Aziz and his mother's food, which is just unbelievable. Lots of rice going down. And honestly, so first few days, I think I was doing it wrong. Talked to some of my friends. Day three, day four, realize that when you break the fast, everybody, just one American's anecdotal relaying of information, you got to do it slowly. And you will never taste a better date in your whole life than when you break the fast at 6:05 and it's the first thing you eat and it is so sweet and satisfying. You got to do that, eat a couple dates, go slow, and then ramp up to eating a full meal much later. That's the other thing. Ramadan things trend a lot later in the evening here. Things really start to get packed out at restaurants at 11 and 12 midnight, and people are sleeping in a little bit later. Anyway, just a little anecdote there. It's amazing. I'm really glad I'm doing that. I know what my friends are going through now, and most of the over 1 billion Muslims are going through around the world. It's amazing because it's an accomplishment at the end of the day. You feel like, hey, you know, I did this. I didn't eat anything for a whole day. And, you know, usually it's about 18 hours for me. So it's a bit of an accomplishment. Honestly, it really makes me appreciate having breakfast and lunch. But it is really cool to stay in touch with my friends and talk about what's going on and how it feels and to get some points of motivation. So love doing that. Second observation, Ramadan, living here in Riyadh as an American, what is amazing and people told me about beforehand and they were absolutely right about was traffic. It is amazing. Nobody's on the roads during the normal hours. So if you're trying to get around in the middle of the day in Riyadh, it is an absolute delight. I have not sat in traffic once before 10 p.m. here in Riyadh. After 10 p.m., people start going out to restaurants. Some of the more popular roads get crowded here. So it's actually kind of like things shift a little bit, but there isn't the rush hour, which is just nice, to be honest. I love it. Last observation I want to note about it, about Ramadan and being here, is that there's a vibe to this season. It's hard really to describe, but there's a generosity of spirit. There's a happiness. There's a change in attitudes. There isn't really an American or a Western holiday comp. A little bit like the Christmas spirit, I guess, but the season is longer. It isn't just one day that you're, it's Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and there's a Christmas season, but Ramadan is really a month. So there's just a different spirit, a different vibe going on. People are very friendly. People are very generous. And I see that not just with the way that I'm treated, which I'm incredibly appreciative of, but also the way I see other people treating other people. And it makes me just really happy to be here and to see this and to witness it for myself and to have my family witness it for themselves. And although they are not fasting and they may have dealt with a grumpy Lucian once or twice here around 3 or 4 o'clock to be expected, I think they're really enjoying it too. And so I guess to just wrap this up, just to say thank you to everyone for making us feel so welcome here. I can't really list all the people that I would like to thank right now without filling the full podcast, but there are some of you who listen to every episode who have really made my and my family's journey here as we've lived here really lovely. And I just want to say thank you for that because I can't really even express how appreciative I am of that. And we're just very happy to be here. Very happy to be here during Ramadan. I will be keeping the fast going. I'm really proud of myself, as I just noted. And so that will be a thing for me. But I just wanted to say best wishes to you all for Ramadan and in this Ramadan season. And it's really great to see all of you. And when I've gotten a chance to see you, I know the first few days are for family and then, you know, you start working in the friends a little bit more. And I just wanted to say that I really appreciate my friendship and I really appreciate being here in Riyadh and in Saudi Arabia. I think it's an amazing time of year and I think it's an amazing experience to see and feel Ramadan for myself. So my best wishes to you all. Okay, let's now get to my conversation with Dr. Hannah Al-Moyabid on Saudi Arabia's economy, the labor market. I think you guys will love this because this kind of touches all the issues of Vision 2030, employment, private sector engagement, all of that. And she just knows it inside and out. And I think you'll love this. Enjoy. I'm speaking now with Dr. Hannah Almoyabid. Dr. Hannah is a busy bee and wears many impressive hats all at once. Based out of London and originally from Al-Khobar, she is founder and director of ProLega Meta Education Advisory, consulting fellow at Chatham House, visiting research fellow at the London School of Economics, research fellow at the King Faisal Center for Research in Islamic Studies. Dr. Hannah, you are also on, you sit on the board of directors at Rawabi Holding Group. This list could actually fill a whole episode. So unless we're going to do this in two parts, I'm going to put a fork in it there and just say, welcome. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So just some background. We met a few weeks ago, Dr. Hannah, at the Human Capability Initiative in Riyadh, and we were supposed to speak together on stage, one-on-one interview, and ultimately we were pulled in separate directions, but we sort of agreed, hey, let's do this on the podcast anyway. Let's come back to human capital and labor. That's sort of one of your professional focuses, and let's do that in a bit. Let's start with your professional journey, some information about you personally. Give us your story.
Okay. I don't know where to start, but I guess I am, as you mentioned, from Al-Khobar. I grew up in kind of Dammam Khobar, Saudi. But I also grew up spending my summers in Seattle, where my mom is from originally. So I kind of grew up in between like sandy beaches in the during the year and the woods and camping and kind of water skiing on the lake in the summers. So it was a really kind of fun just upbringing. And then I actually left Saudi my senior year of high school to finish high school in the US. My brother and sister were already studying abroad at the time. And I graduated from a school in Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft headquarters are, and started my undergrad at the University of Washington. And I kind of started right into international studies, which was this really interdisciplinary kind of anthropology, political economy, whatever, sociology, all of the social sciences mixed into one, but with a really big focus on international relations. And I focused most of my work on kind of the study of the Arab world, the Islamic world. And it was really interesting to see that through the lenses of the professors and the literature that we were using at the University of Washington. And I think just to highlight one really cool experience that I had when I was there is I, in my senior year of undergrad, did this program called Arab and American Identities in Crisis, and it was in Cyprus, and it was basically this effort to take a group of students from the US, a group of students from the Arab American University in Cairo and the American University in Beirut, and put us all in this remote village and kind of kick the beehive and talk about all of our identity issues and kind of the issues that define our relationships. And what I loved about that was I kind of belonged in both groups, or all three groups really on some level, but also was very different because I was not Lebanese and I was not Egyptian and I was kind of American. And I guess what that did is it really kind of shaped the next chapter, this 1 3-week program, which was, you know, a random thing that I'd added as a short study abroad kind of program. Because I went on to do development studies and really kind of understand more of the Arab world, more of the developing world, and try and see kind of what my role would be in, I don't know, solving our identity issues and building bridges. From development economics, I went back at the London School of Economics here in London. I then went on to work in Saudi, and my first job was a startup. I was the VP of content development and social responsibility in a startup, which was the restaurants group, really. But we had established, or I kind of co-established this idea for a cafe library where we were importing fair trade tea and coffee and trying to kind of educate the community about what that meant. This was back in 2005, so there wasn't really fair trade tea or coffee available at the time, and nobody really knew what we were talking about. The company grew, but I didn't stay for very long. I did end up actually running it for a bit as CEO, but I left because I think my heart's in education and working with young people. And while we were able to do a lot of that in Otakoshe, which was the name of the cafe, By running community programs and literacy programs and things like that. I wanted to work in an educational setting. So I taught for 3 years while at the same time working on kind of action research with the American University in Beirut through the school I was teaching in, Lahran Ehliya, which is also the school I went to. I still am really good friends with a lot of the students. We built a lot of really cool things together, an MUN club that is now one of the best in the Eastern province. We traveled together quite a bit. There was an economics, a global issues course. All of these things were things that I was enabled to develop and kind of start opening up the eyes of the young women that I was teaching to the things that I was really excited about when I was doing my international studies and development programs. And then from there, I left and I worked at Rawabi for 5 years, managing their corporate social responsibility, which focused on youth empowerment. And we really looked at careers and young people's career transitions and how confused they get. And that inspired my PhD, which I moved to London for 9 years ago now. I finished it like in 2019, but I'm still here. But that really looked at young people's choices in education, career transitions. It was inspired by the work I did at Rawabi, the teaching that I did. And also, you know, for me, one of the most crucial institutions we need to think about when we think about development is education. And so it was a really good opportunity to kind of delve deeper into that and look at the intersection between education and careers and work.
I see. That's exactly why I think this could have been a two-part episode. We could have just focused this first one totally on your story, which is absolutely fascinating. And that is very much a distinctive and perfect American accent. I'm glad to hear that has not eroded in any way with 9 years in London. That's just terrific to hear and a really amazing story. I do think, though, that we should talk a little bit about the labor market in Saudi Arabia, some trends in that, and basically, I just want to start by jumping in. You joined as a guest on the Babbel podcast, which for me is a must listen, with repeat guest here on the 966, Dr. John Alterman. He asked you in 2021, what is the general shape of the Saudi labor market? What are Saudis' employment prospects? And I really just, if I could get you talking about that, updating your answer from that, it's now 2024. Vision 2030 is 3 years older. The non-oil economy is humming. What is the state of the Saudi labor market today?
Yeah, I think it's really important to update that because things have changed so much. And I think what's interesting for me is kind of when I went on Babbel, I was talking about some of the findings from my PhD, and even that data was already outdated. So now kind of building on the research that I've done throughout the years since that podcast and kind of work with different entities and data collection and interactions with different people, it's a very different landscape for sure. I'm going to start with a couple of statistics only because like people want to hear that and it really helps set the stage. So there was a recent census in that kind of, you know, there was almost a recalibration of the population. So there's 32.2 million people in Saudi Arabia, 58.4% of that are Saudi, and then 41.6 are expats. 63% of the Saudi population is under age 30. So we do often talk about how young of a population it is. And the average age is 25. But it's really grown so much. I mean, I think about when my father talks about when he was young and the population in kind of 1965 was between 4 and 6 million, and now it's 32, and that's not a really long time. And also it's increased by 8.2 million only since 2010. So it's really grown quite a bit. And when you think about that, you think about kind of the pace of change and then the growth and the number of people that are now living in the kingdom, it helps contextualize it a little bit. It's like it was a tiny place not very long ago. The GDP per capita is 29,900. Again, it's kind of in the middle. It's not a super in terms of kind of everybody's ability to spend. And I think people also think of Saudi sometimes as really rich, and that's also a misconception. There's a variation in wealth and income levels as well. But the unemployment level today is the lowest it's ever been. The overall unemployment rate is 5.1%, which is quite low, and 8.6% for Saudi nationals. So that really means that Saudis are starting to find jobs in sectors maybe they weren't thinking about going into in the past. The unemployment rate is highest for young people between ages 15 and 24, which especially for women, which is at 27%. But women's labor force participation has grown significantly. It's now reached around 36%, kind of between 35 and 37, depending on the quarter that we're looking at. And around 95% of unemployed Saudis today say that they might be happy to work in the private sector. The public sector still dominates. It's decreasing, though, but still 53.1% of Saudis work in the public sector. Okay, I think, though, these are the stats, right? But really, Lucien, what's important is that we look at the story behind these numbers, right? And when it comes to the labor market, you have a diversification plan at the moment that has really invigorated a thriving tourism and entertainment sector, new manufacturing, logistics opportunities, a private sector that's supported by innovative, active labor market policies, government support for new small and medium enterprises, lots of skilling and upskilling opportunities, a thriving VC and angel investment landscape. There are more women, again, as we mentioned, entering the labor market with transportation and childcare support, anti-harassment laws that really enable women to go there with confidence, and young people that are truly inspired, intelligent, and motivated. So the numbers are definitely moving in the right direction, but then that qualitative dimension that we don't talk about enough really does paint the picture of where we're probably going.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on a lot there. And that was terrific. I sort of, if we can like just pick that apart individually and start, I think, most broadly with the private sector specifically. When you think about Saudi Arabia, historically, the government was really the driver of job creation in the kingdom. This dates back decades. They're working to change that. You mentioned the diversification plans underway. And then elements of that, VC, private equity, all of these things coming in to create jobs. Part of that, though, is also in creating a strong private sector is the attitude change, right? You can create private sector employment opportunities galore, but if people don't want them or view them a certain way, and actually, because you mentioned some data from the recent release of the Saudi GA stat data, which I think is 2023, Q3 is the very latest. We have another update coming in a few weeks, but you mentioned one of these statistics in that 94.7%, 95% of unemployed Saudis would accept employment in the private sector. Talk to me about how Saudis are viewing the private sector. Is it changing? I mean, is that sort of statistic, does that say it all?
Anecdotally, and just based on the research that we've done in the past couple of years, I think there's two things, right? So one, the private sector is growing and the public sector supposed to be shrinking, right? We're supposed to be creating less jobs in the public sector. So there might just be less opportunities. It might just be more difficult for people to find those jobs. But I think it's much deeper than that. And I think that one of the things that we need to think about is just how important family has been. So I believe there's a real generational dimension to this question. People have, and young people especially, have traditionally really done what their parents have wanted them to do. And there's a lot of status that used to be attached to working in government. And that's really related to kind of the historical evolution of how jobs were created for in the formal economy in Saudi anyways. And what's happened with this generational shift is, you know, maybe 10 years ago, kind of also pre-vision, there weren't necessarily lucrative jobs in the private sector that it kind of were available to that many people, potentially. There were, but it wasn't as big as it is meant to be now. And I think that there's been pressure from family members to follow in the footsteps of the parents and do what's expected and not break with social norm. And now with the expansion of the private sector and the support for things like establishing your own business and kind of these kind of SME support, you have a narrative shift. So it's not as risky. Your parents aren't going to be like, what are you doing? This is crazy. You need to do what I did. Instead, they're like, okay, well, you know, maybe there are opportunities for you that are different from what I chose to do. And they actually look pretty good. So I think that's part of the story that maybe isn't told with that number. It helps explain it a little bit. But that's, I think, to some degree what's happening. It's just like social mobility almost that's happening. And it's an intergenerational change that's really starting to unfold in a way based on the reality on the ground and kind of the support that you're getting. The narrative is shifting and people are changing their attitudes, I think.
What sectors are Saudi youth today really embracing or sort of looking at that they may not have been looking at before?
I mean, I think young people really are following jobs, right? So I don't know that they're necessarily drawn to a specific sector, but I was thinking about this and I was looking at kind of some of the LinkedIn data that's been reported on. And there are sectors that were not on people's radars in the past that are now in high demand. So topping that list, according to LinkedIn, are sustainability and environmental managers. And from a personal experience, I can tell you that that is a very difficult position to recruit for. So that's an area where, you know, if Saudis are looking at where the demand is and where job postings are, that's a new kind of sector to go into, thinking about what sustainability means and the green economy and also ESG reporting and all of those things. That's something a lot of companies are trying to embrace because of new regulations and the direction the CMA is taking sustainability reporting to. So I think that's one thing. I also have seen a lot that's related to data analytics, cybersecurity, and so on. And so those are areas maybe people were interested in the past, but it's expanding a lot, as well as human resource development and management. And that's obviously because we have a changing, diversifying economy, growing private sector, and you need people, and talent is really tricky to find. I also think that in answering this question, it's really important to follow the vision, right? So I think that if you think about the new industries that young Saudis might be going into, it's important to look at some of the new ministries, the new programs that are there, and some of the new giga projects as well, and what types of talent is needed there. So there's definitely an attraction of talent from around the world to come and work in some of the new sectors, but there's a message in that, which is talent from abroad is welcome as long as there is also an exchange of knowledge and a transfer of a lot of that expertise. And so where you do see new developments happening in kind of, you know, arts and culture and entertainment in an area that was completely absent in the past, there are young Saudis going into these sectors now as well. Again, it's becoming acceptable. So there's that narrative shift because there's support financially as well as like a lot of prestige that's attached to going into these sectors. But there's also funding and training and new scholarships to go and specialize in these areas. So these are new sectors for sure. I mean, in the Saudi that I grew up in, there were times where we weren't even allowed to buy music, let alone train to be musicians. So I think it's really shifting kind of the perceptions. And young people today don't know the Saudi I grew up in, right? That's an ancient past to them. But if I were the parent thinking about what I want my child to do, again, thinking about the family structures and how how important those are, I think it's important to think that the shift needs to come from the top first, but then you have to create those opportunities, and young Saudis are able to embrace that because it's happening in both directions.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating because I think most Americans only know or only think of the Saudi you grew up in. And that's the big challenge, is that they don't really see the Saudi as it is now, which is changing so quickly. Just adding Absolutely. A data point to what you were talking about, which I think is so fascinating. The unemployed Saudis used a variety of active job search methods, and the average total job search methods was 4.8 active methods per job seeker. So they're searching online, they're using other methods to find jobs. So ostensibly their placement is quicker because they're sort of spreading the net wider than it was in the past. I want to talk a little bit about technical and vocational training. This is something that you've written a lot about, and I think you've touched a lot on the themes of that, but that leads to the question about how younger Saudis are taking jobs as skilled worker jobs. They're sort of, instead of going to a foreign college, I mean, this was only a small subsect anyway, but, you know, learning a degree, getting a degree and then coming back and looking for a job in some of the blue chip industries like banking or being a lawyer. And it seems like because of that youth bulge, which was 70% under 30, now I think it's 60% under 30, you mentioned, This is sort of an important part of Vision 2030 and its success, getting these Saudis to get into those jobs. So like, what is the government doing to, you know, fast track that, to make it quicker and easier and more enjoyable for them? And are young Saudis embracing those jobs in the way that the government wants to see?
Yes, to some degree, it's definitely going in the right direction. So I think for me, just thinking about vocational education globally, it is always seen as, almost always seen as, a second choice. The research that I did on this was looking at kind of the narratives that are kind of emerged from how people talked about opportunities in vocational education and training. And for many, and the majority of the young people that I spoke to, quite a few years back now, they thought of it as, a last resort kind of career stopper. And the reason for that didn't really have to do with the nature of the work itself. It really had to do with kind of a couple of things. But one of them was that they weren't finding good jobs at the other end of this training, because employers were really looking for people that had bachelor's degrees. And now that employers need specific skills, they are offering better jobs and more lucrative salaries for young people that have the vocational degrees and are basically offering training for them in order to really get them quickly into the companies and working. And that's the benefit of vocational education and training, is it doesn't have to be 4 years with a lot of theory. It is very practical. And that is kind of what vocational education is. It's training for work. And as long as there are good jobs at the other end of the training that you do, young people are very happy to go into that. But the narratives really weren't positive, because they were feeling, A, that they weren't finding the work that they were doing, and B, there was a stigma attached to them because they were looked at as failures that weren't able to get an academic degree, because the process makes it look like you failed out of academia and then you have to do vocational training. So as long as we continue to work on elevating the status and showing that it's an active choice that young people are making, and presenting it as a viable one with a career growth opportunity at the other end of it, then young people will continue to pursue that. And that is happening. And there are some really interesting structures that are being put into place to really enable young people to go into that. So very interesting partnerships with different training entities, three-part partnerships, which include industry as well. So training that ends in employment, which young Saudis really like, is part of the process. But, it's growing and it's still limited in terms of how many young people can go into some of these more lucrative vocational training pathways. So the more partnerships we can build that are innovative, that really are offering great jobs on the other end, the better.
You use a term just now, you said good jobs, and this is a term that you've written about, good jobs and bad jobs. You co-authored a paper for the King Faisal Center for Research in Islamic Studies with Dr. Mark Thompson, another previous guest on this show, on employment attitudes, perceptions, priorities in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What is a good job and what's a bad job? This is also something that His Royal Highness the Crown Prince has discussed in public as well. Can we talk about that concept, explore it a little bit?
Yeah, His Royal Highness Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman mentioned good jobs and bad jobs in a really famous Ramadan interview in 2021, which was really directed at Saudis, right? It wasn't for an international audience. It was in Arabic, and it was an event. I remember watching it and just like being so excited to hear kind of the plans laid out in the way that he did. And I think one of the things that he had said was that at the moment, he believes that only 50% of jobs in the market are good jobs. And the goal is to raise that to at least 80% in the first instance. And, what are good jobs to him? He was saying that good jobs were basically jobs that don't just provide your basic needs, but they're the ones that enable you to save, that enable you to invest, and enable you to live a happy, healthy, and fulfilled livelihood. And I think that the paper that Mark and I wrote really does kind of unpack how the notions of what a good job and a bad job in Saudi are. And we did that by speaking to kind of an older generation of Saudis and understanding how they started working in formal employment to begin with, and what they were willing to accept to do, and if there was this perception of a good and a bad job back in the day when they were just starting out. And really what many of them said was, we wanted any job. There is no such thing as a bad job, because we were just looking for work. And that was, it goes again to the evolution of kind of the formal economy in the kingdom. But I think what they did kind of highlight was how geographic like elements of employment perceptions were different. So, you know, it was really related to whatever the traditional kind of activities were in those different regions in the West or in the East or in Riyadh. And so they just kind of embraced the local economies. And many of these people, because they started working, some of them went abroad and came back, but many of them were kind of the initial commercial families that became the kind of the people that established certain industries within the kingdom, just because they were in the formal economy when it made sense. And then they created more jobs for other people. And because they had this perception that work was really important, it was all about the work ethic. It was all about taking a little bit of risk. For them, a good job was a job that opened up opportunities for other people. A good job was a job that built on the networks that were already existing within those geographic locations, and expanded them. And a good job was one that really kind of provided opportunities for growth and expansion. And there was a risk element to it. Now, I think that maybe some of that risk went away with the way young people went into the public sector and started working in very secure jobs after that. And now some of that risk appetite is coming back, and that's kind of going back to the roots of where it all started. And so that's a little bit exciting thinking about that it's not a new thing. There were some really big risk takers in the 50s and 60s in Saudi, and their grandkids are now, you know, given the opportunity to take some big risks today as well. But yeah, I mean, it's a subjective thing what a good job is, but I think that the research that we've done really shows that there are elements that make people satisfied in a job that, you know, that vary. But it's an important thing to look at when you're thinking about growing the economy.
Dr. Hannah, you may hear it now in the background. The Maghrib prayer has just been called, and that is also the sound of my stomach rumbling really badly right now. So if that's what you hear, I'm very sorry. I have two questions left for you. First, you're currently working on something, a study, and you've sort of referenced your most recent research. What are you doing right now?
I'm working on a really fun project, actually, with an entity, which is a non-profit in Saudi called Mohiba. And they are the Giftedness and Creativity Foundation. And they work very closely with the Ministry of Education to help young people really kind of find their gifts, if you will, their academic gifts. But our project is really following the young Saudi team between 14 and 18 year olds that are competing to represent Saudi Arabia in Los Angeles this year. It's called the International Science and Engineering Fair that they're going to. And this is a group of 35 Saudis that was kind of picked out of an initial 200,000 that applied for this job or for this competition, sorry. We're kind of really interested in the relationships and the social capital that they get from participating in this kind of competition. There's so many, I've talked about family, I've talked about networks and linkages, and there's a lot that happens in this type of competition where these young people are coming from all the corners of the kingdom and coming together to form a united kind of Saudi team and going and representing their country abroad. But then each one is individually responsible for winning, and competing in the different areas that they're looking at. There's like 21 different scientific areas, and some of them I can't even pronounce, but they're really smart and they're really motivated and they have incredible ability to build networks and to use that to really leverage their futures. So I see this as a space where young Saudis are almost creating the future networks, right? And it supersedes kind of what's happened in the past. And it looks like almost these new connections are going to be way stronger than the connections that they've had that are built on tribal relationships, that are built on existing geographic ties and so on. So I'm really excited to kind of present this when it's ready and kind of showcase what young people are saying about their futures. I'm just going to say, like, just visiting the exhibitions where they've presented their research so far, I think we're going to be okay, actually.
The last question that I sort of need to get to, and I feel like is worth its own episode, but women in the Saudi labor market, and you've mentioned this in various parts in this interview, all of this data that comes out of GA Stat, when you look at just one quarter, is just a snapshot. But the trend in general, when you take it out long enough, is in the right direction. So I guess the broad way to ask a question about Saudi women in the workforce is, what is the status of their entry into the workforce? How does it compare to their international peers, either the regional or international? And how much more is there to go? What are the challenges left?
So, I mean, if you want to ask first, I'm going to talk about how they compare. First of all, they were at the bottom of the table, and now they're at the top of the table in terms of the number of women that are participating in the labor market in the GCC. And the growth has been just incredible. It's happened so quickly. And really all you needed was just almost the decision really to push it forward. There have been efforts to get more women in the labor market for many years, but it's really, it's worked very well. And, you had about 19% participating in 2016. And now, as you mentioned, 35% participation rate in 2024. And I think, women are in all sectors, from kind of working as executives, their ambassadors, to women working as Uber drivers and, kind of in retail and security and the legal kind of field as well. And, everywhere. And what I think is really important, the story we need to tell, is that active labor market policies to get women into work are really important. Supporting women with transportation, childcare, but also flexi work and the ability to manage their competing demands is really important. And that's happening now, kind of at a scale that it's not happened in the past. And the anti-discrimination policy also really helps make it feel like a safer environment. The numbers look really good. They're, 22%, I think, or 20 was the vision goal initially, and it exceeded that already. Maybe it was too low, and we're very ambitious women. But I think the really important thing to highlight is, now that we have women in the workplace, we need to make sure that there is room for women to make decisions in all of the positions that they're in and to grow within their careers. And so some of the things that are important are thinking about kind of their starting salaries, their negotiation power, and what they know about the labor market and where they can access this type of information. So that's really important as a next step. And another thing that's really important is to make sure that the environments are really supportive. So they are to some degree at the moment, but there's a lot of work, and we all know that the work is needed globally to close things like gender pay gaps, to make it so it's more inclusive and more enabling for women. And I think that that's the type of work that we have to do now. And I think just one last point on that is the most important part of this whole thing is that Saudi women need to be the ones that are defining what it is that they need in the workplace. And it shouldn't be a narrative that's imported from outside of the kingdom and just kind of cookie cutter, we need to do this with D&I and we need to do, that's not going to work. I think Saudi women have needs that are their own and they need to drive that. And a lot of it will overlap with global needs and global women's challenges. There are a lot of shared and communal challenges, but there are also ones that women in Saudi Arabia need to outline and define themselves.
Dr. Hannah Almoyabid, thank you so much for your time, your insights, just absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Hannah Almoyabid on Saudi Arabia's economy and the labor market. She is just an amazing communicator and truly a really good person. And I really enjoyed that conversation. I think there's going to be a lot more coming, so stay tuned. Take care. Thanks so much. Masalama.